Okay, I think we can start this morning's Dharma talk. And subject for this morning's Dharma talk, just continuing on a little bit from even what I said this morning about living with Ajahn Chah, and just the happiness which he would instill in you, and how that the happiness became an important part of the path, both in wisdom and in meditation, in your general life, and even in the goal. And the gradual training, which I talked about in the sutta class yesterday, that gradual training was from the second sutta of the Digha Nikaya called the Samanyapala Sutta, which means the fruits of the holy life. And it was a discourse from close to the last year of the Buddha's life, when the Buddha was staying in the bamboo grove in Rajagaha, and the new king, Ajatasattu, just wanted to see the Buddha for the first time on a full moon night. And the new king just asked his doctor, Jivaka, where to go. And so Jivaka took him to the hall in the bamboo grove in Rajagaha. And the first part of that story was something which I've used as a metaphor, analogy, because it says that the king went in the chariot, as far as the chariot could take him. And then from the chariot, he went by foot, with his sandals, as far as his sandals could take him. And then he had to take his sandals off when he went into the hall. And as an aside, that the king just had to ask Jivaka, when there's all these bhikkhus assembled in the hall, which one is the Buddha? And there the king said, the person, the monk who is sitting against the post facing east. And number one, that the king could not pick out which monk was the Buddha. It wasn't that by his facial features or by his size that he stood out amongst others. And as against that, recently I was given one of these awards, and one of the other people who was awarded one of these medals was the Australian basketball star, Luke Longley. Because he's a basketball star, you know, he is about 7 foot tall. And actually he couldn't come, but his father came to receive the award, and his father's just as tall. He certainly stood out. You didn't need to ask which one he was. But the Buddha never stood out at all in the sense of having facial features which stood out. And also that because that he was sitting facing east, it seems to be that that became almost tradition for Buddha statues, to them to face east. And when I said that, you probably looked at that Buddha statue behind, to my left. You may have looked at the Buddha statue over in Bodhinyana. And when we first put that Buddha statue in, fortunately I wasn't the boss, so all the criticisms came to Ajahn Chakro. And then when we had a visiting Thai monk, not Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah was actually sick by the time we got to Bodhinyana monastery land, but one of his senior monks. And it's the first time the Thai senior monk came to Bodhinyana monastery, and the Thai people took the opportunity to complain. These Western monks, they don't know what they're doing. The Buddha statue is facing west. If you go to Bodhinyana monastery, they should be facing east. And the Thai monk said, it's been up there for about a year. If the Buddha statue didn't like it, he would have turned around by himself. And that's a typical of that humour which you got in those monasteries. Down to earth and just to the point and solving a lot of problems. And also for those of you, when you come into Jhana Grove, you know that the monk... okay, I'll go back to Ajatasattu in a moment. The monk who offered the stupas and the lions, as you come in here, he offered those to us and we erected them here. But when Handaka, some of you know Handaka, he's the head of the Ahipasako Foundation, he's the one who looks after me when I go to Indonesia. And when he came to visit, he took one look at those lions and said, they're the wrong way round. One is male, one is female, and actually they should have been the other way round. I said, oh yes, but you forget one thing, Handaka. This is Australia, down under. Things go round the other way down. So you always have smart answers, because laughter was part of my tradition. But anyway, just going back to the king, I've used that many times to say that when you start a meditation practice, you're going into deep states of meditation, you use, say, the breath as far as the breath can take you. And then you have to let the breath go. And nimittas, as far as nimittas can take you. And then you let the nimitta go, you go merge into it and you just got bliss. Each one of these are vehicles. And it doesn't mean you have to be aware of the breath right from the very beginnings of meditation until the jhanas. The breath is a vehicle. And when it's taken as far as you can take you, then you stop. Actually, just automatically, you get into something more refined. And then more refined, and then more refined still. So when even in the breath meditation, don't think the breath has to be there all the time. That does confuse people, because the breath starts to disappear and you think you've lost your meditation object. No, the meditation object does change. It refines as you go deeper into stillness. And anyway, so that was that simile of Ajatasattu. But when Ajatasattu paid respects to the Buddha, he realized that the Buddha was royalty. And he said, why are you doing this? Why are you living like this? You know, you could have a big palace, you can have lots of dancing girls or whatever else you like. You can have the greatest food, you don't have to fast in the afternoon. And then that's when the Buddha said, sort of, with all of your power and wealth as a king, you don't even have a fraction of the happiness which I have as a Buddha. And then he taught the gradual training of the increasing happinesses which actually come from this path, what real joy and happiness truly are. All starting by getting some inspiration and faith, because you know what it's like when you don't know which way you're going and you have no meaning in life. That's one of the reasons why meaning... I know that once there was this spiritual sage called Krishnamurti, and someone once asked him, what's the meaning of life? And with a scowl, he said, meaning? Life doesn't have meaning. Life is. It's a smart answer, but it doesn't actually help. And it's also not quite correct. If things don't have meaning, you get very lost in life, very disappointed, even to the point where, you know, sometimes tragedies happen, you know, like you lose a child. What is the meaning of that? And when parents think, it's a loss, it's so bad, why did this happen? If somehow you can find meaning in the difficulties and pain of life, what it means, it's not a useless, hopeless, meaningless, obviously, event. You can actually work something out of this and get something. Please excuse me for this one, because sometimes people get very upset with me when I tell this story, but it's real, and the consequences are quite impressive. It was when I was in Kuala Lumpur once. There was teaching some meditation, but the people in the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, they asked me, they said, there is a lady who's come for counselling, but there's nothing we can do for her. You know, she's really in a big mess. And maybe the monk can help. So, you know, these are those cases where they pick out a monk who happens to be there and just to see if it works. And so they said, if I want to know what happened, I said, no, don't tell me. Because sometimes if you hear the story first and you start thinking about it, you can't really dive into it and get that wisdom of silence and get some interesting answers. So she came and told me about this horrendous assault which she had experienced. Very violent rape. And she explained this, she told me, and it's just disgusting what happens. But I listened. And I listened without any judgment or commentary. Just listened and felt the pain as much as I can. Because sometimes you don't know what it's like for other people's suffering and pain. You can only just touch it at a distance and get some, maybe a fraction or 1% of what it would feel like. And having told me the story, not thinking, not judging, keeping my mind thought free, then it was my turn to speak. And what came out shocked me, let alone her. It came out by itself. No premeditation, no force. And I said to her, you were so lucky you were raped. Whoa! That even shocked me. And for her, it was just electricity bolt. What? She hadn't heard that before. How could you say that? And that was what I thought afterwards. How could I say that? What did I mean? And then from that different way of looking, even just outrageous way of looking, then I realized what I meant. I elaborated. And I said that I can never really understand what you went through. But I can see some insight, some intuition, some knowledge of your inner strength and your abilities, that you will be able to find a way out of this really dark hole, this very deep pit of despair, of anger, and all the other negative emotions which come from that experience. You'll find a way out. I'll maybe not be there to help you, but I know you will. And when you do come out, you'll be able to do something which I will never ever be able to do, which is way beyond my abilities. You'll be able to meet someone else who's gone through that or something similar. You will be able to put your arm around them and say, I know. I know how you feel. I can't say that, but you'll be able to. And you'll be able to go further, say, not only do I know how you feel, but I know the way out. Take my hand, come with me on the long journey out. So that is your meaning. That's all I could do. Give meaning to what became just what was like a horrendous sort of dark experience. Something you can do with it to give it a purpose. And that worked. It's a very dangerous thing for a monk to do, say things like that. But nevertheless, it came out just from silence, some courage. It gave one of the most purposeless, harshest, darkest experiences a meaning. So when life does have some sort of meaning, then of course we have a path. And the path which I liked most was the meaning, the path, was reading all these teachings of the Buddha as a student. It was supposed to be ending suffering, transcending it, being peaceful, being free. And I knew that any teacher I wanted to be a disciple of had to be able to show me that they didn't just know the theories. They weren't just the professors or people who could write books. They were people who actually could transcend and had given meaning to their lives and known the answers so that they showed that in their happiness. Not just happiness when you're having a good time, but happiness when you were in great difficulty as well. And that was one of the poems I recalled. Simple poems. It's easy enough to be happy when life goes along like a song. But the one worthwhile is the one who can smile when everything goes all wrong. Do things ever go wrong in your life? Do you get into difficulties and troubles? And it's not your fault? So what do? Give it meaning. Learn. Grow. And that means after a while you find that you're happy. One of those sources of happiness from the teaching to the King Ajatasattu was simple thing like keeping precepts. Being good. Because when I was teaching a retreat before we had this center, in another center in Rockingham, that it was an old nunnery, and so there was a church next to it. And on Sunday, I was in the room waiting for the next person to come in for interview, and I just happened to look out the window and see these two elderly gentlemen, Catholics, just shaking hands and wishing each other well as they left the church. And one said to the other, "Be good," and the other one said, "No, that's no fun." And I thought, what are you talking about? I don't know what you think being good is, but for me, being good is having a good time. Being good, responsible, aware, and happy. And that's one thing which, when you do keep your precepts, the things like not killing, stealing, committing adultery, lying, taking alcohol or drugs, your average level of happiness goes up. It's weird, but it's as if whenever you do anything wrong or bad or selfish at the expense of others, that does have an immediate karmic effect. You feel guilty, you feel terrible, you feel... But just being kind gives you huge sources of happiness. And just being generous. It's amazing, just years ago, a simple act of kindness which I did when I was going through Changi Airport. I can't get it out of my head. I keep thinking about it. That I was passing through Changi Airport and there was some Westerner who was on one of the couches. She was twisting and turning because she's obviously between flights and trying to get some sleep. And, you know, it was noisy, but it's also glary lights. And I had one of the iPads, you know, which I was talking about, the eye shades. And then she turned around, rubbing her eyes. She looked at me, just glancing, because was passing by, and said, "Hey, have one of these, some iPads." She looked at me, "Really? Yeah, here, have them." And that was just enough to make my day. A simple act. I don't know about big acts of kindness. And I remember that. I don't remember all the bad things I've done. I don't know, just my character, I just learn from those, let them go. But the good things, that's a cause of happiness, goodness, a great source of joy and happiness, which you have. And it's also, I think, I've known a lot of you for a while now, and so, you know, you trust me and I trust you. That goodness makes, you can relax in a person's presence. I know you're not going to try and manipulate me or get something out of me or take me, scam me or something, because, you know, you're reasonably honest. You may not be as, you may think that I'm over-exaggerating, because you know yourself, you think more than I do. But nah, you're okay. You're not that bad. So because of that, that goodness, this is a happy place. You can leave things around and people will give them back to you. They don't steal. They don't sort of harm you. And that's actually, people tell me that's quite rare in this world. That you can trust strangers. But that goodness gives you a wonderful uplift. You feel good, other people feel good. And then the other thing was this sense of restraint. Basically, simplicity. When you have a simple lifestyle, you don't have very much. And then you're so free, like the bird. That freedom, simplicity, not having to worry about so much. You don't need so much. You don't need to show off with different styles or whatever. So it's great as a monk. I can just live a simple life, and it is encouraged. So, living simply makes you happy. And that just means you're simple, you've got not that many burdens, so that when you meditate, you've got nothing much to think about. The past, yeah, you've lived a good life. And sometimes at the committee, our Buddhist Society of Western Australia, they've just, you know, they're looking to the future, and we have a strategy group, you know, just getting a bigger picture instead of just worrying about what to do today and how to pay off this bill and how to amend that and what should we do for the next retreat. Look at that, stand back and look at the big picture, a long-term strategy. You know, one of the things they were telling me with the long-term strategy, they said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, that, you know, you've been leading this, you know, have we got a succession plan yet? So, succession plan? Are you trying to get rid of me? Has some doctor told you something which you haven't let me know yet? Oh, I'm dying! Ah! And so even when we talk about dying, you know, it's just we have a good laugh. There was. It was a German monk who was in Australia. He was over in Sydney. And he was the oldest monk, the most senior Western monk in Australia. And he died a couple of years ago. And when he died, of course, I went to the funeral ceremony. And they announced that the eldest, most senior monk in Australia, Western monk, had passed away. And then I got up there and said, that means I'm now the most senior monk. I'm next. There was one of those monks, he's not the most senior, but I really love and like this monk, Tan Harry. He was from Sydney, from Balmain. And he wrote this really good book called From Balmain to Buddha. It's like life story. I don't know where you can get hold of it, but I really like reading that. The opening line really caught me, because Balmain was the port area of Sydney. That was really rough. I mean, really sort of like the Bronx of New York. Tough, hard, poor. And he said, if you still had your two front teeth by the time you were three, you were a girl. That's really tough. And it's but, you know, in his life, he also got a job as a funeral director. You know, the funeral directors? And he told some terrible, funny yarns. He said in Sydney that, you know, funeral, they have to dress in black and they'll be really somber. And there was this one old gentleman who had died in one of these Sydney apartment blocks, you know, the old ones, you know, in the top, you know, where they had stairs. They did have an elevator lift, but it was very narrow, and stairs going all the way to the top. And people had lived in there for years. They all knew each other. So when they went into the flat in the top and, you know, to pick up the body, you know, they have these little, like, gurneys, like these, to actually to put the bodies in so they can take them to the hearse in the back, or in the bottom. And the stairs were far too narrow to get this like a mobile stretcher in, this gurney. And even the elevator was too small, and there's only one of them. So they thought, what could they do? So, you know, just a couple of Australian guys, you know, trying to figure out what you should do as funeral directors. So they thought there's only one thing to do. So they picked him up, and with the two men in black on either side and the dead man in the middle, they got into the elevator. They only just fatted. And they pressed, you know, the ground floor button, just hoping and praying that no one would interrupt their descent to the ground floor. But of course, there is something called Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it will happen. And sure enough, there were these two guys in black holding this dead man in between. And it stopped halfway down. Everyone knew one another. And as the doors opened, there's a little old lady sort of, you know, waiting to go to the shops. And then she saw this man she knew was dead, standing up, these two sinister men on either side. And then Harry said, he doesn't know how this happened, but they lost hold of the man, and the man went falling towards them. He said, well, what can we do? So the woman fainted clearly away. So they grabbed the guy and just brought him back up. they went down to the bottom, and one of them quickly ran up the stairs, thinking they'd probably have to connect another customer. Unfortunately, you know, she'd only fainted, and they sort of brought her around and explained the matter to her, and then. Some of the amazing stuff which happened. And it does happen. It's even in my life, you know, just not being a funeral director, but talking at many funerals and doing these services for people when they die. And there was one family, you know, quite a wealthy Chinese family, and of course they wanted the coffin to be the best. So what happened was that they put all these things on the outside, you know, to make it look good. And then when they lowered it in the grave, it got stuck. It got stuck halfway. And they tried to put it up, and that made it more stuck. They tried to put it down, it was stuck. And I usually do this chanting. You know, it's the, now that loving kindness sutta in the Pali, Karaniya Mata Kusalena. And I kept on chanting and chanting, second round, third round, fourth round, as I was trying to put it on. They eventually got it down. But it's not as scary and spooky as in Adelaide Cemetery. In the cemetery in Adelaide, it's, for some reason, everything is clay. So whenever they would dig the hole for the grave, and they would formally like lower the coffin into the grave, then sometimes there was a rainstorm. And because it was clay, the rain had nowhere else to go, but actually filled up the hole. And there with all the family and friends standing around, the coffin floating up. true story. Anyway, we have a really interesting life as a monk. So all that sort of fun and games and laughter which we have. So when it comes to adding laughter to life, Ajahn Chah was great at that. But also laughter which showed great wisdom too. And part of that laughter, the great wisdom, which he was once, I was there at the time, he was approached by an official on a diplomatic passport from Sweden, a professor. And the professor was sent by the Swedish government, this was many years ago, probably 40 years ago, to actually to investigate this thing called meditation. Because I'd heard that meditation was really amazing to help people, not just in their spiritual life, but in health and many other areas. So the Swedish government had actually sent him to go to as many gurus and meditation masters of all traditions he could find in Asia, and to actually do a survey. And this was where the professor would ask four questions, the same four questions of each of the teachers, to in order to like compare, you know, ask the same question to systemize the research. So when it came to Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah couldn't speak English or Swedish, so had to go through a translator. And so he received a diplomat, you know, with, he was on a diplomatic passport because he's on an errand from the Swedish government, with appropriate respect, and asked, you know, how he was and what he was there for and what these four questions were. And so as soon as he heard what the four questions were, and that it was, you know, from the Swedish government, and for once Ajahn Chah should behave, that, of course he didn't. He asked for a piece of paper and a pencil. It's the only time I've ever seen him ask for a piece of paper and a pencil to write down the answers. And he wrote them down. He was an actor, but a very wise, enlightened one. That was his character. He wrote them down, he gave them to the translator, and after laughing, the translator replied, "The answer to your first question, the four questions, first of all, is what is meditation? How do you meditate? Why do you meditate? What do you get out of meditation?" So, what is meditation? And the monk replied in English, "My master's reply is, what is eating? Why do you meditate?" My answer, my teacher's answer is, "Why do you eat?" And he said, "How do you meditate?" You guessed it, the answer is, "How do you eat?" What do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? And you should have seen that professor. He was not happy. He said, "I can't take that back to my government. But he said, that's all I'm giving you. And they were very profound answers. We laughed, but I always remember those answers. What is eating? Do you actually have an eating guru to tell you how to eat? Do you go to eating retreats? Actually, that might be a good fundraiser for the Bodhinyana. Anyway, eating is something you do for your health. And really, you do have to enjoy eating. In the monastery I've been there once in Japan, a Heiji monastery. It's in the west coast of Japan, in a very, very windy, snowy, cold, really bad weather area. And in that monastery, there were some of the toughest of monks. Dogen founded that monastery. And everything is harsh. In the morning, you have to wash your face, 0 degrees centigrade water, no hot water, work hard, and sit meditation, go through pain. But the one thing, he always said, to have delicious food. When I first saw that, I said, what are you talking about? That's more indulgence. And he said, have delicious food. And sometimes you think, why? Why even here do we make sure that, you know, you have a nice food to eat? And the reason is, I'll tell you now, close your eyes. And it's only for 30 seconds, so don't need to change your posture. Close your eyes and now think of your favorite food. Just think of it. You can almost smell it. You can see it steaming in the bowl in front of you. You can almost imagine it going into your mouth, your favorite food. You can open your eyes now. You know, it's easy to keep your attention on your favorite food. Your breath, no way. But when you were doing that, you feel saliva coming out of your mouth. You see your tummy start to turn as all those other liquids are needed. Because I learned that when one of the monks, he had bad digestion, as you can imagine from eating frog on rice. And so they send him over to get a barium meal. I don't know if it's any doctors or nurses. This like radioactive sludge, which you have to drink. And then they follow it through an x-ray to see if there's any blockages anywhere. And so he had the appointment in the hospital and they gave him this radioactive sludge, which he drank. And then it just sat in his tummy, didn't move at all. It was in the afternoon, he's only used to eating one meal a day. And so his stomach was actually not working then. It was resting, because it got used to resting in the afternoon. The stomach didn't do anything. And fortunately, the nurse knew Wat Pa Pong and said, ah, yes. Now, monk, think of your favorite food. And as soon as he thought of his favorite food, everything started moving. If you think of your worst food, it will stay still. So even for digestion, to keep you healthy. Even the Buddha said, delicious food, okay. Because to keep you healthy, the taste of the food is important for you to be able to digest it. Because otherwise, the saliva, the bile, I forget all the other stuff which is secreted to digest the food, just doesn't come out. So you don't digest anything. So anyway, the Ajahn Chah, what is eating? What is meditating? It's food for the heart, food for the mind. And quite frankly, that even sometimes if I get busy and if I don't find time to meditate, you do feel like weak in your mind, just like you felt weak in your body if you didn't eat for a few days. The mind has not got its oomph to it, it hasn't got its energy, it can't teach the Dhamma, it can't just inspire people with a smile because you're weak energy. So meditating is like eating for the food, for the heart. And again, how do you meditate? How do you eat? You know how to eat. When you're very mindful of eating especially, You know, you notice how much, you don't rush it. You know, because the food is, to actually get the best taste out of it, digest it the most, you savour it. You don't just throw it down your mouth. Another thing which I learned as a meditator, even when I was a lay person, if you went out, say, with a girlfriend, as a layman that was, and then you had a meal, especially if you paid a lot of money for that meal, you wanted to be mindful of it, pay attention to it. So if the girl sitting next to you started to speak, shut up, I'm eating. I paid a lot of money, I've got to enjoy it. Or maybe that's one of the reasons that I never got married. They couldn't stand me. I was weird. But it is true, if you actually taste the food in your silence, you actually enjoy it more. You know, you're not distracted. So, you know, how do you eat? How do you meditate? And then why? It's, you know, for health. And what do you get out of eating? What do you get out of meditating? Good health and energy to do whatever job, whatever you need to do in this life. If you are working in the corporate world, if you are a nurse in a hospital, a carer, a volunteer, a monk or a nun, live at home as a mother or a father, or as a grandparent, you need that energy, that mindfulness, that care. It allows you to do a really good job in this world. And of course, that when there is difficulties in life, that's when the meditation really assists you, as you get some amazing ideas and wisdom. And you can start to experiment and see amazing things which you can do with your body to keep it healthy, to serve other people, when you know how to meditate. For example, with sickness, or with irritation. Let's do the mosquito story. When Ajahn Chah was a tough teacher, but it was fun. We enjoyed it. And when Ajahn Chah, we first started this Wat Ba Na Na Chat. It was actually its first name, because most of those monks there were Americans. The first name of that monastery was Wat Ba America Wat. Because there were so many Americans there, you know, from the Vietnam War. And they became Na Na Chat, because there's more than Americans there. And he would come every evening for the first few weeks of the monastery to actually to give support. So what he would do, we would meditate for 2 hours and then he would give a Dhamma talk, then he'd go back to Wat Ba Phong. But when we meditated for 2 hours, it was from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. in the jungles. Now that was the time, 6 to 8 p.m. was mosquito dinner time. And all these mosquitoes would come out of the forest. That was the worst time of the day for them, at dusk. And you'd be sitting there being devoured by these mosquitoes. Now, first of all, just look at me and compare you. There's more seats at the dinner table when you're a monk. Bare shoulder, bare arms, bare head. There's more places those mosquitoes can actually drink from. Number two, this was the first time that there was Westerners in that part of the world. I went on a arms round once and in one of the villages, and the people giving the alms food, the bit of rice, they're not supposed to look at the face. They're supposed to pay attention, be mindful of putting the sticky rice in the bowl. When I went past, they hadn't seen even a white man before, let alone a white monk. And the dogs loved me because it fell out. The rice fell outside my bowl and the dogs ate it. So, this was the first time those mosquitoes had Western food. And there's something else I never understood at the time, but those mosquitoes would always go for the Westerners. Somebody said afterwards, because the blood vessels were higher up or lower up or whatever, but You saw Ajahn Chah, he maybe got a couple of mosquitoes on him, but we got hundreds, literally. Because I remember with another monk, we played a game at first to see how many mosquitoes we could count at one time on our body. I said, no, I tell truth, 60 or 70. We couldn't sort of get further than that because they were basically too close together. That was how difficult it was. Fortunately, we never got malaria. Malaria wasn't in that area. But there's still lots and lots of mosquitoes, and that was really irritating. And so a lot of times we would endure, you know, the old willpower, just sit it out. And often you'd open your eyes and see Ajahn Chah, your teacher, was sitting there. If he wasn't there, you'd probably run away. Make some excuse. But pride is very strong. And so, you know, you couldn't run away, you couldn't endure it. So what did you do? So that's where I learned a lot about meditation. Just to go inside, create a little bubble, and then just go inside to the center of things. Like the eye of the storm. Always going in and in and in. And you'd learn there just to let go of your body. Watching your breath, and you can feel mosquitoes are over there somewhere. And you go deeper and deeper into the breath until you couldn't feel the body anymore. And then you had a nice quiet meditation. Because if your mind wandered, it would go to the body and you feel all these mosquitoes on it. And after doing that for a few days, you really got into it, and you thank the mosquitoes for teaching you how to do your meditation properly, to let go. But then a weird thing happened, that going inside, you know, when you were meditating, when I came out afterwards, you know, I looked at my arm and said, well, there's no the mosquito bites visible. Because when a Westerner gets a mosquito bite, a little bump comes out, a little welt comes up afterwards. But I looked, there's nothing there. I thought, wow, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. The psychic power of deep meditation. You become invulnerable to mosquitoes. Until later on you discover, no, it's something else. And this makes sense with like worrying, wisdom and freedom. Because it wasn't a fact of anything supernatural. It was the fact that mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide coming out of the pores of your skin. That's what actually attracts them to you. So the more you worry about mosquitoes, the more your metabolism goes up, the more carbon dioxide you actually emit. It's as if the more you're scared of mosquitoes biting you, the more you're saying, mosquito over here I am, bite me. But when you really relax, you're not having any worry, really calm, getting very peaceful, your breath gets very light. And the reason the breath gets very light is because your metabolism goes way down. You don't need oxygen because just your machines are just humming along in neutral. And so because you're not emitting much carbon dioxide from your pores, because you're very calm and still, that was why the mosquitoes couldn't find me. So you became invisible to them. I thought that was really cool. But anyway, that's the sort of stuff which you learnt from while you meditate. You have so many benefits. How you meditate, a lot of times it's just such a natural process. You just let go. To the point that these days that you come across people who are natural meditators, who just maybe because they had some trauma in their life, they went inside to escape and they found a nice, peaceful, calm place. Or this friend, he was the one who actually typed up my Open the Door of Your Heart book. He was a soldier in the British Army and he had migraines, chronic migraines. And whenever he had a migraine attack, he would find the nearest place to go inside with no light, in darkness. And he said he would go inside. He said he was once, this was many years ago, in the British Army on manoeuvres in Germany with a group of soldiers. He was their sergeant. And they were told over their radio to, you know, take a break for a cup of tea. That's an important part of British Army discipline, having a cup of tea many times a day. So they all had a cup of tea. He had a migraine, so he went into a barn in a farmyard close by. And then when the word came to move, the soldiers got back in their lorry and started moving, but they forgot him. About half a mile down the road, we've forgotten our sergeant. So they turned around, went to the barn, and he was still there, perfectly still. And they had to pick him up physically. Soldiers aren't the most gentle beings. Pick him up and dump him in the back of the lorry. A little while later, he came out and went, "Where had I get in here? I was in the barn." And they told him. He'd got into a deep meditation. He would say he did this all the time as the only escape he could do to get away from his migraines. Later on in his life, the migraines disappeared. They didn't come back anymore. And he also lost his jhanas too. And he said, "Oh, I wish I could get back into... I don't want the migraines anymore," he said, "but I wish I could get back into those deep, lovely states." So the people actually can do these things, you know, because of something or other, I don't know why. And it's nice for them to be able to know what they are and what meditation can do, why you do it and how it works. And sometimes how it makes you very, very light-hearted. And so some of those stories of Ajahn Chah, strict, not using willpower, but using wisdom power and using joy and being inspired by all of the wonderful stories which he would give. And some of them were, you can never forget them. The last story which I'll say about Ajahn Chah today, the great wisdom, but which was so helpful for us young monks. I was in the back of a car with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was in the passenger seat, had a Thai driver, and there were two other monks sitting next to me in the back. We were going to the railway station in Warin. And suddenly, without warning, he turned around to one of the novice monks sitting next to me. Gary, his name was. "Gary," said the translator, why are you thinking about your girlfriend in Los Angeles?" You had to be very careful what you were thinking about in the company of Ajahn Chah. You can get busted at any time. I felt so sorry for this young monk, novice, because it was true, that's what he was thinking of. And he was he was so embarrassed. But Ajahn Chah was just so compassionate. He said, "Look, we can help you. The next..." Many of you know what's coming. But you know, a good old story, anticipation is really important. And even though you know what's going to happen next, still, it's funny. He said, "We can help you, Gary." He said, "Next time you write to your girlfriend, ask her to send you something of hers, something intimate, something close, something personal, so you can remember her." And of course, even I was surprised. I didn't think that was allowable as a monk. I thought you were supposed to let go and renounce and just separate and just, you know, not sort of restrain the senses. Because I know that's something they used to do, a lock of her hair, you know, a bit of her dress with a scent on it or something, a photograph, something you can remind when you're lonely in the huts, eating frog and rice, being devoured by mosquitoes. "Ah, that's my girl." "So that, you can't do that." He said, "Oh yeah, 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 compassion's important, kindness." And then what he said next took such a long time for the translator to render into English, because he had to stop laughing first. He said, ask her to send a little bottle and ask her to put some of her shit in it. And whenever you feel lonely, whenever you miss her, open the top. Oh, that's my girlfriend, and I love everything about you, darling. So that answers how strict Ajahn Chah was. He was funny, he was wise, and some of the stuff he said, you know, because it was funny, it was wise, you never forgot it. How many of you know the third link of dependent origination? Well, you've got to think about that one. But when it comes to Ajahn Chah's advice when you're really sick, you'll either get better or you'll die. You always remember that one. So some of the stuff which he taught, simple one-liners, were so powerful. Rather than strict and being scared, it was fun, joyful, wise. You could always see growth. Got time for one more little anecdote of Ajahn Chah. I think the last time I visited Wat Pa Phong, I showed, you know, some of the people who were with me the place where this happened, because, well, you remember these things. I was with him on his arms round, so I could carry his bowl afterwards, and he stopped by the side of the road. And he picked up a stick. He said, Brahma Wangso, is this heavy? And before I could actually answer, he'd thrown it away. It's only heavy when you hold it. All your worries, concerns, problems, are they heavy? Only when you hold it and carry it around are they heavy. And then he carries on the arms round. What are you worried about? What concerns you? Finances, health, relationships. They're only heavy when you hold them. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. The same thing goes for nuns, by the way. If a nun misses her boyfriend, that was outrageous.